The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to City Bible Forum today. My name is Russell Matthews. We want to welcome you to City Bible Forum. Thanks for coming along today. And continuing in the series, the second week of the series of Ecclesiastes, An Honest Look at Life. Today's speaker is Al Stewart. And the talk today is definitely taking on small things, but the search for meaning. And what we do at City Bible Forum, and the reason why we call it a forum in particular, is that we do give you opportunity to kind of dialogue with the speaker. After he gives his talk, you're more than welcome to write down any questions that you have on the series, this portion of the Bible, maybe the topics that he brought up during the day today. Write those questions down. I'll give you time to kind of think about that after his talk. I'll give some brief announcements explaining some of the things inside and also on the back of your outline. All right. Well, let's go ahead and get started. If you want to, go ahead and open up your outline, and I'm going to start at the sentence mark number 12, I, the teacher. I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the sun. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. I've seen all things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I thought to myself, look, I've grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. When I applied myself to understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly, but I learned that this, too, is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. Al.
Thanks, Russ. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. Well, it's not a lot of enthusiasm, but it's some. Okay, as I look around, I think a few people have... A little tired Thursday, getting towards the end of the week. I wonder this year, did anyone make it to the Royal Easter Show? Would you like to just kind of nod or maybe just throw anyone? There's a few. Okay, well done. I haven't been to the Easter Show for a while, but as I think back, yeah, some of the things I liked, you had to get used to the crowds, didn't like that so much, but I always went and saw the wood chops, which were always kind of fun. And just to raise the cultural level here at City Bible Forum, I reckon the flying pigs were great, kind of down the slippery dip and into, I don't know why that's funny, but I just enjoyed them. But I haven't been to the Easter Show for a while. Why? Because for Kathy and myself, our kids have all grown. They're all young adults now. They've moved out of home. And I think the Easter Show is really only great fun if you take little kids. Because it's all new and fun to them. You watch a little kid's face as you walk down Sideshow Alley and you come to the clowns, you know, kind of, and the ping pong balls and stuff. They get all excited. And the voice of experience wants to say, oh, mate, like it costs $5 or $6 or $7 and you won't win anything. Oh, but look at the big toys. Yeah, but those toys, those big stuffed toys, they've been there longer than I've been alive. Those toys are older than me, huh? And if you were unlucky enough to win one, I'll tell you what'll happen. It's bigger than you until you're about 17 or 18 years old. You'll never play with it. It'll be a bit scary. It'll sit in the corner of your room and gather dust for the next 15 years until you go on schoolies and your mother throws it out. Oh, no, let's go off to the show bag pavilion. Oh, the show bag pavilion. They cost a fortune. The toys will be broken by the time you get home, and by that time anyway, you won't want to play with them because you'll have eaten the 3 kilos of sugar that's in the show bag, and you'll have thrown up. And so, but they still want to do it. Now, why? Why do they still want to do it? Because it's all new. It's all fun. But once you've been around the block a few times, show bags, clowns, it's all a bit kind of, I guess I'll take grandchildren one day. The trouble is, as you get older, I think more and more of life seems like show bags and clowns, doesn't it? We get disillusioned and tired with so many things in life. And so each generation, you know, the new politicians come along and they promise to change the world. I think they believe they will, but they promise to change the world and there'll be some new health funding thing that'll change the world. And most of us think, ho-hum, or at work, there's some big new project that's coming, or some kind of, we do the haka about something, say the new product and the new this and that, and those of us who've been around the block think, ho-hum. And more of life becomes showbags and clowns, or perhaps it just feels like it's run by clowns, but that's what life feels like. Now, what is there in life that really lasts, that really delivers? What is there in life that isn't showbags and clowns? That's the question that the book of Ecclesiastes asks. Ecclesiastes, a book that's found in the middle of the Old Testament. It's a part of the wisdom literature in the Old Testament, part of the Bible, written either by King Solomon, who was the greatest king in the ancient world in Israel, rich and powerful, about 1000 BC, or written through his eyes later as he was the patron of the wisdom literature. And he begins looking at the world, and just let me get you up to speed if you missed last week as we looked at the introduction. Chapter 1, verse 2 says, "Meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher, "utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless." We'll come back to this again and again. It's a refrain that happens again and again through the book. And that word meaningless, in the Hebrew language, the word hebel, literally it means a mist or a vapor, something that's kind of fleeting. It's there for a little while and it's not. You know, yesterday morning there was a fog on Parramatta River, and around the city you could see the fog, and then the sun came up properly and it's gone. It was fleeting. And it means it's something that's hard to get a hold of, something that slips through your fingers. And it's kind of ironic, really. The English translators have trouble getting a hold on that word. And so different versions of the Bible have tried to translate it. For example, the King James Bible, which is 400 years old next year, when they translated from the Hebrew, they went for vanity, as in the sense of it's all vain. Vanity of vanities. Everything's in vain. Here, the New International Version's gone for meaningless. I can get that. But just remember, as you read Ecclesiastes, if you read it's fleeting, it's a vapor, it actually drops things into focus a little more. What's he saying? Everything is meaningless. Nothing lasts. It's all a vapor. It kind of slips through our fingers. We can't hold on to it. It doesn't finally deliver. Why does he think that? Well, look at the question he's been asking here on the screen in 1 verse 3. He says, "What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun?" So what does man, like people, humanity, what do we gain? And the gain word, it's a commercial term. It's the idea of what is the profit, what's the bottom line, what's the take-home value, the dividend, all that. What's left? What do we have to hold on to after all our work? That little phrase, under the sun. Key part of understanding Ecclesiastes. What does he mean? He means if you look out at our world on a beautiful sunny day like today, what do you see? If you have your brain switched on and your eyes and your ears open, what is it that you see? Now, he's not an atheist, not at all. In fact, he says intuitively we know that God is there. And the vast majority of people, in survey after survey, still believe in a God of some kind. But he says, as he writes Ecclesiastes, he says, well, if God hadn't spoken to us, if all we had was our common sense and our intuition under the sun, what would we see? And that's what he's looking for. And he begins by saying, life looks meaningless. It's a mist, a vapor that you can't hold on to. And last week we looked at the introduction, chapter 1, verses 1 to 11. It's on the CBF website if you'd like to be thoroughly depressed. Because what did we decide after we'd looked at it? There's an endless routine to the world. Sun goes up, sun goes down, sun goes up, sun goes down. Nothing ever changes. We're only here for 5 minutes in comparison. It's boring while we are, and no one will remember us. All right? I'm glad you came back this week. Okay, so what does he do? He says, no, look, I've got wisdom and I've got money and I've got time and I'm going to find something under the sun that lasts, that delivers. Look at now we're moving into the program you've got. We've printed out from chapter 1, verse 12, or it'll be on the screen. He says, "I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men." I'll say more about the burden particularly in 2 weeks' time. But what's the burden? Well, verse 14, "I have seen all the things that are done under heaven. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind." And you couldn't think of anything more kind of useless than chasing the wind. Then a proverb, verse 15, "What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted." there's something wrong with our world and things that we just can't fix. Have you ever wondered why, for all of our technology and all of the wealth we can produce and all of the food that we can grow, why is it that there are millions and millions of people on the planet that go to bed hungry, and there are millions and millions of people on the planet that struggle with obesity? Why can't we fix that? The states and the federal government are talking about health funding at the moment, and they've been trying to fix it for years and years and years, and now one side says it's totally fixed, and I hear Jeff Kennett on the radio saying this morning, it won't be fixed, but we won't know for 3 years, etc. Who's right? I don't know, but with all the goodwill in the world and all the money that seems to be, why can't we fix it? He's saying it's always that way. We get richer and richer, it's never enough. Verse 16, I thought to myself, look, I've grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Verse 17, then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. But I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. And what's he going to say? What's wrong with wisdom? Well, it comes back later to wisdom, but one of the problems, look at verse 18. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. My guess is many of us went to university. If you think back to university days, you think of which tribe at university really enjoyed themselves. Think of the philosophy students. Did they enjoy themselves? No. No, they often dressed in black, had kind of emo haircut, walked around, carried big books and looked haunted. Why? They actually read stuff and they thought about things. Miserable. What was the tribe that enjoyed themselves? The engineers who drank a lot and played rugby. Are you happier after you listen to the news in the morning? Why do we do it? I ask myself that every morning. Or why are little kids so happy? Well, the cynic might say, because they're really dumb. Not exactly, but just life hasn't bitten them yet. They haven't been around the block enough to be disillusioned. He says, no, come on, let's find something that's going to last. Let's find something that's not hebel, not meaningless. Maybe pleasure. So he has a look. Let's have a look at pleasure. Chapter 2, verse 1. I thought in my heart, come now, I'll test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. And notice what he says. He doesn't say pleasure is bad, and he doesn't say don't enjoy yourself. What he's saying is that pleasure is a mist or a vapor. He's not saying don't enjoy yourself. He's not an aesthetic. But what's the point? He's saying it's meaningless. You can't hold on to it. And that's right, I think. Pleasure is like splashing your face with cold water. You grab your hands, you splash your face, and what's left in your hands at the end? Nothing. It was pleasant, and it's gone. And you can't hold on to pleasure. You know those times when you've been with your friends and it's been the right people there and the right meal or dinner party or whatever and it's just been great, or you've got all your family together and it's really worked? Don't you wish you could just kind of freeze that moment and hang on to it and it slips through our fingers like water when we wash our face? Verse 2, laughter, I said, is foolish. And what does pleasure accomplish? Ironically, laughter is actually a way for many people to hide a sad heart. That's what the proverb says when he quotes the book of Proverbs. There's a proverb chapter in Proverbs 14. I'll show you on the screen. It says, even in laughter the heart may ache and joy may end in grief. What does he mean? We often laugh to cover up the heartaches in life. And humour is very often like a shock absorber in a car trying to take the kind of bumps out of the road. And I've noticed, actually, the people often with the best senses of humour are the people who are kind of quietly depressed as well. And they see the foolishness and so on of life and can point it out, and their heart aches. Maybe it's party time will work. Verse 3, I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. So still thinking, but let's go and experiment with this. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. You throw yourself into drinking and partying, and it's fun for a little while, but one of two things happens. Either it gets boring and you grow out of it, or it destroys you. It's funny, at 21, it's not when you get into your 50s, hard drinking and partying and so on. Well, maybe it's not that. Maybe it's in creating beautiful things, in building things that give us pleasure and so on. And man, Solomon had all the money in the world to do it. Verse 4, I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. You know, if you go to Jerusalem today, or you can cheat, just Google it on Google Images, there are still the pools that Solomon built. You can go to Solomon's reservoirs or pools. They're still there. He made all these beautiful things. Didn't stop there. Verse 7. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers and a harem as well, the delights of the heart of man. The history books of the Old Testament tell us that King Solomon was incredibly wealthy. 1 Kings 11 tells us he also had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines. Concubines like a reserve grade wife as well. So 1,000 women. Wonderful gentleman, isn't it, till you actually think about it. He had three wedding anniversaries every day. He spent 7 years building the temple, this magnificent gold-covered thing that was built in Jerusalem, and then 13 years building his own palace. Incredible. People came from all over the known world to see it. He says, verse 9, I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was a reward for all my labor. Have you ever fantasized about having enough money that you could actually have anything you want? Anything. There's been a few people in history who've been able to do that. Some of the great industry tycoons and so on. And then the richest man of our age is Bill Gates. Bill bought a house, and for him, here's the picture of the house, for him it cost actually a fairly small amount, the $200 million. But what can you pack into a house for $200 million? You mean Bill sat down and thought, here we go. One of the most interesting things you'd experience if you lived in this house is that you wear a pin containing a microchip which acts as your personal ID. When you walk into a room, lighting, sound, and temperature controls are customized for you. Any high-resolution display that you walk by will know that you're there, and your favorite art is displayed. And if you're getting a phone call, only the phone nearest you will ring. We have that built into our place as well. We have one phone. But what did Bill decide to have? Well, he has a pool house with a 60-foot swimming pool. There's a reception hall for guests and so on. The house is 50,000 square feet. There's 64 kilometres of optical cable optical fibre cable we used. It has a trampoline room, as you do, a formal dining room where 24 of his closest guests can sit at the table, an underground garage with space for 10 cars, hidden cameras all over the property, floor sensors that can track you up to where you are, up to within 6 inches, and all flooring is heated, including the driveway and the sidewalks. That's what he came up with. I mean, other people who've thought, well, man, what if I own my own amusement park? And so Michael Jackson bought Neverland Ranch. It's 1,000 hectares, 2,600 acres. And of course, that meant he lived a happy and content and calm life, didn't it? No. You see what Solomon says in verse 11? Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. He doesn't use the logic. What he just says is, I built it all, and I got to the end and I looked around and I thought, is this all there is? I can't hold on to it. It'll slip through my fingers. I leave it to someone else. Isn't it strange that we think with our house or whatever it is, if I just had a bigger house, I'd be happier? And we got to have a place to live, sure, but to think that's the meaning of life? Tell you how to get it in perspective is when you fly into Sydney and look out the window, and what do you see? Just endless miles of little red boxes, you know, that a fly puts his foot over and you can't see from the air. And we think that's going to be the meaning of life? If I had a slightly bigger box, it would be better. Have you ever thought about what it would be like to have everything you ever wanted? It's interesting how often people who get to the very top and say, there's nothing there. You may remember in December that Tiger Woods had a, what would you call it, a meltdown in his life and his career and all these revelations of Tiger Woods and other women and so on. Peter Fitzsimons, who writes for the Herald, I keep reading Peter Fitzsimons, he's always bashing Christians. I know we're a bit of a slow-moving target, but he does it in a funny way, so I keep reading. But he had a theory about what was going on with Tiger Woods, and I think he's pretty close to the mark. Let me read to you what he says about Tiger Woods, the man who has everything. In the middle of the whole kind of drama, he says, "Let's cut to the chase on Tiger. What's the upshot when perhaps the most famous and admired man in the world, with $1 billion in the tin and a beautiful wife and two children and staggering sporting achievements on his resume, turns out to be a serial adulterer setting new records in sleaze? A man who, to judge by the fact that after just a week of revelations, he is well into the back nine of mistresses, probably has dozens more out there. Try this for a theory. I reckon he's so bored out of his brain. I reckon that when you live a life like he does, where everything is catered for, when wherever you go you are fawned over, when you never have the remotest worry over finance or have to think twice about the fact that the gutter is leaking, your kid's nappy needs changing, the washer needs fixing, and it's your turn to cook dinner, you become so bored, that when a woman says, 'How about some strange sex in the back of your hotel room at 2 a.m?' you say, 'Yes. Yes, anything, anything. Just get me out, just help me escape from this godforsaken, sheeny, shiny corporate bubble of a life. This eternal axis of golf course, limo, hotel, private plane, limo, home, limo, corporate meeting, sponsors meeting, and on. Let me feel something real and different, even if they are mostly silicon. And you get so hooked on it that pretty soon your mind has learned to line up the women around the world wherever you go. None of which excuses him in any way. But I reckon it's an explanation.'" Isn't it interesting? Anything you want, and I think he's probably right. And we keep thinking the next thing will do it. The next thing will deliver. And what we build and buy just ultimately doesn't satisfy. And Solomon said, I stopped and I looked and I thought, well, if this doesn't answer it, maybe it is wisdom after all. See verse 12. "Then I turn my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. What more can the king's successor do than what has already been done?" He's done it all. "I thought that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head, while the fool walks in darkness." See, if you're wise, you understand the world, you can see where you're going. "But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both." Well, here's four very famous wise men. Albert Einstein, the physicist, Edwin Hubble, the astronomer, William Shockley, who invented the transistor, and Bertrand Russell, mathematician and philosopher. Now, what do those four guys have in common? Well, at one level, they're four of Time magazine's list of key thinkers and scientists in the 20th century. At a deeper level, what do they have in common? They're all dead. And all of their wisdom and all of their learning was kind of just buried with them. The same as someone who'd never thought a thought or never read a book. Verse 15, "And I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said in my heart, this too is meaningless." Notice this is fleeting, it doesn't last. "Meaningless. For the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In days to come, both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die." And so Bertrand Russell, with all of his learning and philosophy and so on, dies. And Anthony Flew, one of the most outspoken atheists of the 20th century, died just recently, although no longer an atheist. And Richard Dawkins, with all his learning and cleverness and so on, he will die. And so Solomon's reaction, verse 17, "So I hated life, because the work that he's done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind." See, for all the wisdom and all the things that we can learn and the incredible steps forward in philosophy, in technology and philosophy and so on, it all comes to a dead end. Let me just leave Ecclesiastes as we come to the end, just for a thought. What if there is a wisdom, and by wisdom, the Bible means a way of understanding how to live in the world. What if there was a wisdom that was beyond what we can learn? A wisdom that is greater than what our philosophy or our science can give. A wisdom that didn't just come to a dead end. And a wisdom that was totally different to what human ingenuity would work out. That's what the Apostle Paul is talking about when he writes to the Christians in Corinth, in the Greek town of Corinth in the first century. Let me show you what he writes in the letter of what we call 1 Corinthians or 1 Corinthians. He writes chapter 1, verse 19, and he's quoting Isaiah the prophet, who's about 800 years before Jesus, another Old Testament prophet, quoting what God says in Isaiah in verse 19. "For it is written," God says, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate." So he'll frustrate our human wisdom. "Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world?" In other words, in our wisdom, our learning, it comes to a dead end. It doesn't have the ultimate answer. Verse 21, Paul says, For since in the wisdom of God, the world, through its wisdom, did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Now notice what he's saying. He's not saying that preaching itself is foolish. You might think it is a bit sometimes, yeah, but it's not the actual activity of preaching, it's the message. He's saying this message that will seem foolishness is how God will rescue people, right? People who believe the message. And what's the message? Here's the part that seems so foolish. Verse 22, "Jews demand miraculous signs." How do you know God's there? How do you know this is, you know, pull a rabbit out of a hat, show some kind of miracle. "Jews demand miraculous signs. Greeks look for wisdom," in other words, philosophical arguments and so on. What's God's alternative? He says, verse 23, "But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles." That means to the first century Jewish world, it was offensive. The stumbling block word is where we get scandal from. It's offensive to some and it's foolishness to others. And it's interesting to note the way that the new atheist movement carry on about the cross of Jesus and how foolish and scandalous, etc. it is. Answer? Exactly. 21st century or first century, it was the same. But you notice verse 24? "But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks," and that was the way of talking about everybody. You're either a Jew or kind of a Greek, a non-Jew. That just means everyone. "Both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God." See, wouldn't it be an irony if in God's wisdom, the power of knowing God and how to live and knowing eternal life is all bound up in trusting a crucified Jewish carpenter. You see how kind of crazy that wisdom is? And why does God do that? To humble us. You actually have to humble yourself to know God and to know his wisdom. Well, next week, money can't buy happiness and why no one actually believes that. Got it? Money can't buy happiness. Everyone thinks, wish I had some to try. Okay. Anyway, that's next week. Russ.
All right, I'll give you a few minutes. If you do have some questions based on the all that was brought to you here today by Al, please write down those questions. Jeffrey will be walking around. We can definitely pick those up. All right. Do we have any questions today? No questions. Wow. All right.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.